You're listening to this podcast, so I know you've got a curious mind. Here's a helpful fact you may not know yet. Drivers who switch and save with Progressive save over $900 on average. Pop over to progressive.com, answer some questions, and you'll get a quick quote with discounts that are easy to come by. In fact, 99% of their auto customers earn at least one discount. Visit progressive.com and see if you can enjoy a little cash back. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $946 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2024 and May 2025. Potential savings will vary.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever think about switching insurance companies to see if you could save some cash? Progressive makes it easy. Just drop in some details about yourself and see if you're eligible to save money when you bundle your home and auto policies. The process only takes minutes, and it could mean hundreds more in your pocket. Visit progressive.com after this episode to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
Hi, this is Dee Blick. Welcome to Lead Well, Live Well for UK Health Radio. Hello and welcome to Lead Well, Live Well with me, Dee Blick for UK Health Radio, the world's number one talk health radio station. Thank you so much for joining us. It's lovely to have your company today. Now, in the studio today, we have a man, a philanthropist that I have counted as a friend for many years. He's also an incredibly successful businessman, the franchiser of a publishing business, Raring to Go. And get this, in his spare time, he has raised over £3 million for children charities. That's actually earned him an MBE in the process. Now, that said, he is one of the most modest people I know, and he never likes blowing his own trumpet. So I'm always blowing the trumpet for him. A warm welcome to the show, Freddie St. George. It's great to have you here.
It's wonderful to be here, Dee. Good to see you.
Right, Freddie. Well, we're going to dive in because I've got lots of questions that I want to ask you that I really want to share with listeners, because I think they're going to be as fascinated with your story as virtually anybody is when they meet you for the first time. So I just want to dive in and talk about the Italian job, your mum, and your proud Italian heritage before we explore where your thirst to raise money for charities came from. And then we'll look at your business as a franchisor of a magazine brand. So lead in with the Italian job, your mum, and your Italian heritage.
I don't know where to start, Dee, but thank you. My mum is now age 92. She's a fierce Neapolitan. So she classifies herself as first Neapolitan and secondly Italian, because many years ago, Naples was the capital of Italy. And as a family, I grew up a bit in Italy and a bit in the UK. As a family, we have always had this strong sense of benevolence and have wanted to do what we can. And we've just had a really old motto in the family, which is those that have more, give more. And many, many years ago, I came across an idea with some friends of mine in an Italian pizzeria in Hove. And we were talking. I was back from university. I went to university in the north of Italy. I'd come back, didn't have any money. I was working with my mum at the time, kind of trying to work out what I was going to do. And we came up with the idea of this Italian job, which was we were going to drive our minis back to Italy, where I'd been at university in the Dolomites, do it as a fundraising event and support children in need and Childline that first year. And stupidly, I sent a press release to Autocar Motor, which they picked up. And in those days, Dee, the press release was typed on a bit of paper, put in an envelope and in the stamp, and then went to the post office and sent it. And then a couple of weeks later, you'd look through the magazine in WH Smith and see it was there. And we had our phone number was in there. No websites in those days, no email in those days, faxes. And we got inundated with people saying, can we join you? Can we come with you? And it literally was a story of from little acorns to oak trees grow. We took 55 cars that first year and raised £70,000 for Children in Need and Childline. And it was the most primitive of road trips you've ever seen. We had hotels booked, meals were booked. We had a fantastic reception from the city of Trento and the Dolomites. And we knew that we'd stumbled into something big in that first year. And pretty much every year since, bar the COVID years, if you'd like to call them that, we've run an Italian Job event. And as you said, we've raised, it's just 3.3 million now for UK children's charities and also children's charities from wherever our teams have come from. So it's been a fantastic journey, fantastic event. And of course, I've got an absolute love for the Mini, love for Italy. So, I mean, it was a perfect idea.
I just find it amazing. I know I never tire of you telling me that story. And I love that phrase, those that have more, give more. And I was thinking, flipping out, we should be getting some of these billionaires that are just sending rockets into space. They could probably cure so much of the world poverty and the disease that we are seeing. And you're there. I mean, like, did you ever think you would reach the stage where you've raised over £3 million for children's charities? Because that is not an insignificant sum. And you always make it sound very easy, but I know there is so much planning goes into making this a success, and you've become a real dab hand at communicating with the media. But when you started out, did you have this huge vision for doing something absolutely extraordinary that would go on for years? Or was it just a case of, let's have a crack at this and see where it takes us?
The latter of the two options. It was absolutely a response to some friends of mine who did the Beaujolais run in 1989. Said it was fantastic, but it was all a bit kind of like boozy, lots to drink, then drove back over too quickly, wasn't fundraising. And our idea was simply as a group of four or five friends to take maybe our five or six minis over to Italy. And my mum got involved. And that's where that when I say she's a fierce Neapolitan, she is the most tenacious. When she's an Italian woman in business in the UK and has lived in the UK since 1964. So she was the one that really took it to the next level and made the deals. We had a conversation with John Cooper, the man whose name appears on the bottom of every Mini Cooper, old style and modern style. And it really was just a machine, a rolling snowball that just gathered momentum and went along. And you said earlier about me being very modest, and I am. I like to think, if I have to think of myself as a philanthropist, as a quiet philanthropist, I want to do, and I use all my energy for doing that rather than beating my chest and saying, look at me, I'm amazing. There are many millionaires and billionaires who are doing amazing things, and they are quietly beavering away and making those differences. But there's an army of people like me who are just getting on and doing it. And I remember once I went in 2001 or two, I think it was, and I did a presentation at a Rotary Club about the Italian Job. And there was a very old man in the Rotarian of this Maidenhead Rotary. And at the end, he came up to me and I'd explained it was me and my mum. We were driving this thing and we'd reached £1 million by then. He came up to me, you know, as only old people can, he grabbed me firmly by the wrist and said, young man, he said, I want to tell you, I really admire your humility. It's very clear to me that you are very humble when you're talking about the achievements. And he said, I don't think you should ever underestimate what you've achieved. And he said, in my experience, those that make the most noise make the least difference, and those that make the biggest difference make the least noise. Now, that man was a man called Sir Nicholas Winston, who we all know now as the English Schindler, the man that saved over 600 young children from Nazi Germany. So for him, and he did that quietly. He did exactly that. He made a massive difference and made very little noise about it. He was the one that was seen on That's Life, if you remember, many years later, surrounded by these children who had grown up into adults. So that's always been a driving force. And, you know, I've got time and energy and ability to give rather than just money. So that in itself has then become a multiplier of the way in which we've raised money through the Italian Job.
I think it's just an incredible story. And I love that. I've heard you tell me that before about being at the Rotary Club and having somebody as incredible as that man making that comment to you. And what I'd like us to do now is pivot to your business acumen, because you're not just a modern day philanthropist, you're a very successful businessman. And I've always admired your culture of being completely inclusive, respectful of listening. Let's talk a little bit now about Raring to Go, and tell us a little bit about what is Raring to Go and some of the changes that you made as this franchisor that was all about being inclusive and open and welcoming.
Sure, yeah. Rowing Together is a very simple concept as a franchise. It's a magazine and an accompanying website, hyperlocal, so that it basically is a go-to guide for families with children at primary schools. It's full of local information, events, what's happening, what's going on, where to go, exciting news from the local town, the local area, that it's so hyperlocal that it really relates to families. It's kind of like what to do with kids when they're outside of school, and not just stick them in front of a blue screen. There is a place for the blue screen, I totally get that. But actually, the great outdoors, arts and crafts, paper mache, cooking with parents, etc. And our magazines are distributed through school book bags, and our franchisees generate revenue through local businesses advertising. And we've made massive changes. When we took the business on in 2005, so this is our 21st year of business, Dee, so we've got a little logo that we're creating as well to celebrate our 21 years of existence. But yeah, our digital platform has now grown incredibly and exponentially over the years, because we recognise that having a flat and static, just a signpost website is not going to butter anyone's parsnips, certainly not the young Generation Z that are coming through today that are looking at our magazines on their phones, on their tablets, on the go. But the interesting thing is they still love the ink on paper. They still love the magazines. So we are still doing, each franchisee produces 10,000 copies. They go out exclusively through school book bags. So there's that inherent trust that we've developed with schools, senior leadership teams in schools. And in that way, we reach the community. It's direct to consumer advertising. And I want our franchise owners, we call them editors, I want them to be called local business and family champions, because they are waving the flag for the local businesses and local families.
I just want, we've got a minute, and I just want to push you on how life has planned out as a franchisor, because you really did bring in this inclusive, open, welcoming. You established a franchise council, didn't you? Absolutely. You know, you're a leader that Absolutely. Leads by bringing everybody into the fold. I'd like you just to, we've got a minute, so I'm not going to let you get away with talking about some of the amazing things you've done when you came into the franchise and gave it a really good shaking up. And
well, the first thing we did was we made ourselves ready to join the British Franchise Association that we weren't able to before. So that meant revising everything from our franchising group. So ground up, basically, we rebuilt the franchise. We got rid of a lot of people in the network that shouldn't have been there. The council was an inspired move and a fantastic decision. I, as the owner, as the franchisor, can make any decision. But the idea and the principle of engaging with your stakeholders at every level, even for the minutiae, ends up being an absolute fantastic success. So case in point, very briefly, 2018, we rebranded, and the Franchise Council were the ones who drove that entire design strategy to create our new branding. And on announcing it at our conference in 2018, I announced it was done by the Franchise Council, and there was emotion. There was applause from the rest of the franchisees. So there is absolutely no question, engagement and bringing them in and having them involved is by far the most successful route to a successful franchisee relationship.
I love it. Now, don't go away. We're going to take a short break. Then after the break, I'm going to be asking Freddie Moore about how he got his MBE, if it opened doors for him, what gives him the most satisfaction in the many roles that he now juggles. So back in a jiffy.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to Lead Well, Live Well. And I've got the fabulous Freddie St. George in the studio today, really giving us an insight into life as a franchisor and as a philanthropist. And Freddie, I wanted to ask you, what are the business lessons that being a franchisor has taught you?
It's taught me an awful lot about human nature, about some people who perhaps from a business perspective are less sophisticated in their preparation for business ownership than is ideal. It certainly taught me a lot about engagement. You know, in within the world of franchising, the McDonald's Big Mac story is actually like folklore. It was a franchisee who suggested to a regional franchise team, why don't we try this thing called the Big Mac? They said initially it'll never fly. and it's flown. It's now one of the three things you think of when you think of McDonald's, Ronald McDonald, the Arches, and the Big Mac. For us, our Big Mac moment was from our franchisees. And again, it's about engagement. We spoke earlier about our council coming up with this. We have an awards system and mechanism within the business that enables us to outreach to local communities and engage on another level with potential advertisers and clients to bring them into the Raring to Go family. And that came entirely from and driven entirely from the franchise network. So it's really made me understand about listening and engaging with your colleagues.
What, are there any times when, what are the challenges? So when you sort of put your head on the pillow at night and you think, I really need to get that sorted out tomorrow. But all entrepreneurs have challenges in their businesses. What are your top two?
Challenges really are cash flow for individual franchisees. And it's always, we have to try and explain, and it's every franchise is the same across the land. Effort is absolutely quantifiable. The amount of effort output has a relation to the amount of income that you can generate. So I get a lot of, I can't make it work, I'm struggling. And then you look and dig deep and see actually it's because there isn't that commitment into the business, because it is very flexible and working around people. Franchise growth has been the next one after COVID for any business, every business I think has been impacted. So regrouping after COVID has been a lot harder and longer than I ever envisaged. And now our franchise recruitment, our FranRec, is very structured, it's very tight, but it's a lot slower in its progress. And we are competing in our price point, because we're a low-cost franchise, sub £15,000. We are competing with many, many others. So we have to really distinguish ourselves as the flag waver and the one to be and the one to be involved with. And we genuinely have an opportunity for people who want to just find a better work-life balance, but also want to be in charge of their destiny. And if they're generating, 10 grand of sales a month, then they're taking the lion's share of that £10,000 of income.
You know, I was listening to you then and I was thinking, because obviously, as you know, I'm a marketer and I'm absolutely fascinated by branding. It's what my book's about.
Yeah.
And one of the real strong pillars of building a successful brand is continuity. And it's when people look at your brand and they can see you've got roots, that you've been somewhere, you're stable, and that you're going somewhere. And I would have thought as well that 21 years is one heck of an accomplishment for any business, let alone a franchise model. That it's incredible that you've reached that point, which is a real testimony to you. And I want to ask you now, obviously, you spin many plates. You're a fundraiser, you're a philanthropist, you're an entrepreneur. What gives you the most satisfaction?
This is going to sound terribly cliche, and I don't mean it to, but absolutely all the roles and activity I play in the third sector are by far the biggest buzz and an energizer for me. You know, I've recently started a role in a very small children's charity in East Grinstead called Jigsaw Southeast. And I am absolutely loving it. I feel like I'm a 13-year-old boy with his first paper round, D. I feel privileged to be standing in front of people and talking about the amazing work that Jigsaw Southeast do, helping families with bereaved children and on that journey into bereavement. And only this week I had my first bid proposal accepted, and there's some money trickling in. And I got so excited. I contacted the director, and I couldn't control myself. So and the Italian job and this idea of giving, I think it's really easy to understand that the human body is physically impacted when we give, and we see the joy of giving. And I just get such a rush. I really do. The endorphins that kind of pump into my brain when everyone's the same. If you give someone a gift and you look in their eyes and you see that they are genuinely grateful and they really appreciate the thought that's gone into that, that gives you a buzz and a rush. And there's nothing to beat it for me, nothing to beat it. Love business. I love the successes in business. I love landing new franchisees, advertising sales and various things, etc. But the thrill and the buzz of knowing that, you're doing something with a purpose is, for me, just the biggest driver.
I know you're working now with Jigsaw. Do you have any lofty I just wonder if you set yourself targets, because I know you're a very target-driven person. in business, as am I, but have you set targets for the amount of money you'd like to raise for Jigsaw? Have you got any bold goals that you've not shared?
Absolutely. I'm looking for lots of local businesses, Sussex, Surrey and Kent, to make a contribution of £1,000 a year or £3,000 a year. And I want to reciprocate that and genuinely reciprocate that. I love the idea of reciprocity, even in giving and building this community in giving so that they all feel part of a community and they can see the tangible difference that even £1,000 can make. And I'm saying that over a year, D. I mean, that's a frothy coffee a week that you just don't have put to one side. And that's where we are. That's what we're saying in terms of income. So yeah, I'd love to. Jigsaw needs £300,000 a year to exist and to operate. And I'd love to be in a point at a position where my endeavours are bringing in the lion's share of that through trust and foundations and through corporate fundraising. We've got an amazing fundraising lead as well. Lots of events going on, and that's where I'd love to be. And again, I just get that absolute thrill. I feel a bit of a fraud as well when I go along to a place and collect a check or do a talk about what Jigsaw does, and everyone thinks I'm amazing. I think I just love it, and the structure of the charity is just so simple. It's very frugal. There's nothing wasteful. If I could show you this office that I'm sitting in now, Dee, you would be big. Properly disappointed, but that's how it should be. It should be a tiny office with no elbow room, no room to swing a cat, everyone falling all over themselves, and putting the, like I said earlier, putting the effort into doing the do. And that's what Jigsaw Southeast do incredibly well.
I think that's amazing. I think it's really hugely inspiring. It made me giggle when you say about you feel a fraud when you go and collect the check. I mean, I look at the amount of work that you've put into it, that you really played a massive part in raising that money, which brings me on to my next question, which is, how did you get your MBE? What, just for listeners that don't know, what does MBE stand for? And I wondered, how did you get it and has it opened doors for you?
Yeah, well, MBE stands for Member of the Order of the British Empire. You can auto-nominate yourselves. I never did that. We had our very first sponsor, a company called Smudge Products, for the Italian job. And I remember we turned up in 1990. They made promotional T-shirts. And we made them. We didn't make them. We asked them if they would consider donating 110 polo shirts with an Italian job logo so that every team on those 70 teams on the Italian job each had a polo shirt, which was branded for the Italian job. And they said yes. And that was run by a guy called Graham Bishop, who I have built an incredible friendship and relationship with over the years. He was my best man at my wedding, and he has been involved in every Italian job since 1990 that we've run, been an incredible supporter and sponsor. And he was the one that took the initiative and put us forward. And both my mother and I were nominated and received MBEs. And I put it on my business card, D. I put it on my email footer. I don't put it on my Zoom screen, Freddie St. George MBE. Some people get confused and think it's an MBA. And I now don't bother correcting them because I think maybe let them think I've got an MBA, which is fine. But it's for me, it's a personal reminder just of the many sacrifices that we've had to make over the years, the investment of time and, of course, money. My businesses have always contributed massively to the Italian job. But it's been it's an absolute joy. And Princess Royal gave me my I was invested by the Princess Royal at Windsor Castle in 2020. And it was just, and my mum came with me because it was during COVID. So I could only take one person. It's an absolute privilege. And it genuinely is an absolute honour to have it.
Oh, it's just fantastic. And I've seen the effect that when you've spoken at events, I've seen the effect that your MBE and who you are has on people. So I think it's wonderful that it opens doors for you for all the right reasons. Now, don't go away again. We move into a short break. And after the break, I'm going to be talking to Freddie about insomnia, if he's got any unfulfilled ambitions. And of course, he will be sharing his favourite quote and asking me a question.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Hello, welcome back to Lead Well, Live Well with me, Dee Brick. Do you know, I wished I had a a £5 note for every time I've been called D Brick, Blake, Bleck, Bonk, yeah. Buck. But I really am D Blick. So with me, D Blick, I'm here with the fabulous Freddie St. George talking about his really taking us on a whistle stop tour of his journey into philanthropy and being a real heart led entrepreneur. But Freddie, I know something that I don't know if it still plagues you, but you used to get insomnia. Is that still the case? And if you do, I've always been absolutely intrigued how you manage to juggle the energy that you bring to every project and yet having this insomnia. Do you still get it?
Oh, absolutely do. Yeah, three, maybe four hours a night on average. And it doesn't matter what time I go to bed, early or late, what I eat, when I stop watching television, if I read, if I take a magnesium. My beautiful wife, Kiri, is massively into homeopathy. So I've tried everything. And you just learn to get on with it and do it, really, to be fair. I mean, it's while I'm on the go and busy, it's fine. If I sit down in front of the television on a Saturday afternoon, I can fall asleep. So it's just one of those. I think it's a blessing and a curse, really. But I'm often I don't have an email footer that says just because I work strange hours, I don't expect you to reply now. But I'll be sending emails at 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning. Once I'm awake, I'm awake. I do go all the way through to the next day. But yeah, I think you just get used to it. I was a terrible sleeper as a baby. My mother will attest to 4 years of perhaps 1 or 2 hours a night. Awful. Must have been horrendous. I was expecting it with my girls. I was blessed, absolutely blessed. They're kind of like good, solid 10 and 12 hour sleepers even now. But yeah, I've you just get to get used to it and get on with it and do a lot of reading, listening to music with headphones at 2 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning. And
I must admit, I don't know how you do it, because it's not like you have a sedentary day. You've got these two massive roles that you fulfill at a really high level. And I've often thought, how on earth do you get, for example, you drive up to Birmingham, you're at conferences, you've just started writing for the magazine that I'm the commissioning editor for, you're test driving cars. And I think something that our listeners need to know is what a brilliant writer you are as well. You're just fabulous at writing. And I look at the quality of the stuff that you do, and it really does astonish me that you can accomplish that on 3 or 4 hours of sleep a night. And I guess, like you said, it's the way that you are wired. For other people, it would be a massive problem.
Yeah.
So I now want to ask you, if you were to crystal ball gaze into the end of the year, what would you like to see on your plate? Not literally, but on the career front, the philanthropy front, what would you like to see?
I would love to see Raring to Go continue to prosper. But I'm a great believer in the idea that sometimes a different captain steers the ship in a slightly different direction, ever forward. I think there's a huge opportunity for someone to do that. I'd like to take a bit of a back step from the day-to-day machinations of being involved in business. I'd love to dedicate more time to the Italian Job events. We do the big Italian Job event, the Mile of Minis event in Oxford in April, and we have Minis at Goodwood in August, which are three, again, fundraising events. Everything we do with the Italian Job is fundraising. And I'd love to put more time and effort into developing a real solid foundation for Jigsaw Southeast, so that in the last year, 1,109 children and young people who are going through a journey with bereavement were supported, but supported brilliantly, Dee, by a team of absolutely amazing, passionate, dedicated professionals here at Jigsaw. They do the heavy lifting. My role is really, really straightforward. It's just to go out and talk about Jigsaw and to twist people's arms and convince them to support in some way. The work that these guys do in the grief support team and the support workers is just incredible. So I'd love to put more effort into that and build a really strong platform for them. And then I think if I could, I'd love to spend more time in Italy, only because I get weary of those winter months, you know, from the clock change in October through to the clock change again in March. I leave the house in the dark. I get home in the dark. I need that vitamin B, and it doesn't have to be blisteringly hot, but slightly bigger ratio of blue skies against grey skies would be my preference. Plus Italian food. My family is there. My girls are now almost independent and growing. They're 21 and 22. So yeah, now is the time to grasp every opportunity to spend as much time as I can there. And of course, I'm not doing those motorway miles anymore. I'm not driving to Manchester for a 2-hour meeting and then driving home. Zoom has been an absolute, you know, amazing introduction into our business. But that was before lockdown as well. But yeah, it's been there's a lot less need for me to be out on the road all the time, which is lovely.
Yeah. Before I ask you how you live well now, just share a bit about your mum, because she's how old is she now?
She's 92, Dee, and she's stone deaf. Obstinate, adamant that she still drives. She still has a personal trainer twice a week. I ask her when she flies to Italy, shall I book special assistance for you? She says, what for me? She doesn't need it. She doesn't want it. And I think she's just the most incredible woman and certainly the most incredible role model I could have wished for, honest to God. She's been absolutely stoic. She's the matriarch of the family in Italian families. The men can pretend to be the bosses and be the ones in charge, but it's always the women, the mums and the nonnas who are the matriarchs and the bosses, and the respect that she commands both within the family and outside is incredible. So organising the Italian job, it's very easy. I'll just send my mum in. She goes in and does it because they have absolute respect for her, and it works. So yeah, she is. She has got a hearing aid. She's had her cataracts done. She's, she's just incredible. She's absolutely incredible. I would never sit in a car as a passenger with her again, though, I have to say, and she won't mind me saying that. Her car looks like it's been driven through a golf course where everyone's taken a shot and hit her car. But other than that, it's she's amazing.
I love that. And when I listen to you speak, and obviously I know you very well now, I can see how you are definitely your mother's son. You know, so many of her redeeming characteristics, her stoicism, her tenacity, her enthusiasm for fundraising has been admirably passed on, and it lives through you. And speaking about living through you, I just wanted to ask that you're a person who gives a lot. You give a lot of energy, a lot of your time. How do you live well now so that you can balance all that giving with a bit of reflection and looking after yourself?
Yeah, I live a very quiet life, Dee. Honestly, I now really much rather know that 5 nights of a week I've got pipe and slippers, not literally a pipe, but I get home and the fire's roaring. That's the good thing about an English winter, isn't it? Then the fire's going. And I'm very happy with 2.5-3 hour evenings around the table with my family. And the hilarity that brings. My daughter's telling me about their day. One is studying, one is working. My wife, Kiri, what her day's been like. She's involved in the rowing to go side of things from a financial control perspective. So we don't talk about that, obviously, at home, but that's a very Italian family affair. We can sit down at 6:30 and get up at 8 o'clock quite happily and longer. But yeah, I just need to, you know, eat well. I don't do a massive amount of exercise, but I tend to keep in shape. I stopped smoking 5 years ago. I'll have an occasional drink, but it's not something I need or crave. I love to socialise with friends. I support friends as well that are going through tough times. I'm an enterprise advisor for East Sussex County Council, so I go into a couple of schools down in East Sussex and help those sixth formers prepare for that transition out of school into whether it be university or the workplace, get a huge buzz out of doing stuff like that. And watching my children grow and seeing them live their lives and I live vicariously through their lives, you know, what they're doing now. And both my daughters have boyfriends and they're starting those new chapters and moving on. So it's a joyful, and I know you're there as well, Dee, with Teddy. And I think, you know, that I think is when we put into perspective what's important in life and how we measure success. It's not money. It's not a Rolex. It's not the flash cars or a big house. This is where it comes to the important stuff, you know, and family and having them, every one of us around ourselves. Yeah.
I love that. I really love that. And I so identify with you, Freddie, when you talk about coming home. It's like you close the door and a quieter life begins, because I give out a lot in terms of energy and activities that it gets towards the end of the day and the last thing I want to do is go out and do something spangly and sparkly. I'm just really happy sitting on the settee, chatting to Malcolm, my other half, having a cup of tea and also reflecting on a day that has been really enjoyable. So I'm with you all the way, and certainly with your family, I'm the same with the boys. It's just lovely seeing how your children are getting on. And before I flick that switch, and you ask me a question, which I don't know what it's going to be, and you also share your inspiring quote. I really just wanted to end by asking if you've accomplished so much in your life, that are there any unfulfilled ambitions on the philanthropy side and on the business side?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I've been using an expression a lot lately. A friend of mine said it to me, so it's not original, but he said that we're at the same age. Our kids went through school together. He's in business, in recruitment, and he keeps using the term, he's closer to the finish line than the start. And that's how I look at this race in business. And I think if we put it into context, it's like, you know, that's the athletic side of my life, the business side of things. I've achieved everything I want to from business. I've enabled and supported many people to actually start in business themselves as well. So I don't have any real ambition for business. I'm lucky. I've never had a desire to acquire wealth or to, and this is going to sound terribly anomalous to people out there that have got a lot of money. I just don't have any great ambition to drive the biggest car, have the biggest house or have the biggest bank account. I want to live a good and happy and a consistent and a healthy life. So in business, no more ambitions really, but certainly on the philanthropy side, the Italian Job is at 3.3 million. I'd love to get to 4 million. I'd love to get to 5 million moving forward. I'd love to make the Italian Job a much bigger, and there's lots of changes this year that are going to be underway. We used to support one big national children's charity, which is amazing, but now we're going to open it up to individual teams fundraising for local causes to them. And I think that's going to really resonate hugely with them, especially if they've been touched by the support. So I look at Jigsaw. There will be families out there that may own a Mini Cooper that think, yeah, we want to do the Italian Job and we want to do it and raise money for Jigsaw Southeast, because they were so amazing when we were going through it. So that's an ambition, to really expand that, and not just to do one big event a year, maybe make 3 or 4 Italian Job events during the year. Lots of ideas for other names, French Connection. We've got a Step into France event, you know, the different car themes that we could do, not just minis either. So looking to really build and grow that. That would be the big ambition.
That is wonderful, Freddie, and I really identified. It's funny, I was sharing in a previous show, I think it was with Emma Ellis, about that feeling that when there's less ahead of you than behind you, it gives you a sense of urgency.
Yeah.
And I'm totally with you, and it's not about money or prestige. It's about being able to leave a really healthy mark on whatever you've done, that you're remembered for that. Which brings me now onto your quote, and then you're going to turn the tables on me with your question. What is the quote that inspires you, and who's it from?
Well, I read it. I think Richard Branson, but I think he just regurgitated. I don't think it's from him, but he said, and I saw it once, and it's always stuck with me, is don't surround yourself with negative people, because they have a problem for every solution you provide. And we've all been there. We've all been in meetings, or we've been in social situations and made a suggestion, and the negative ones, oh yeah, but, and those are they steal the ground from under your feet. So I wake up after very few hours a day and I am absolutely flying. I am buzzing and ready to go from that second onwards. And that first point of negativity is, it just brings you back down to earth crashing. So I make a deliberate decision to not surround myself with negative people, because I know they will have a problem for every solution that you present. So that's kind of been, and that's a little mantra that I remind myself an awful lot. It's the yeah, but, you know what, and the ums and ahs that take away that magic, I think, a little bit.
You know, I haven't heard that. I think it's absolutely brilliant. I'm going to have to scribble that down. And what's your question for me, Freddie, before we say goodbye and thank you for your amazing interview today?
Well, I know you're an author, business author predominantly, but you've also written a work of fiction. And in that work of fiction, it was based very much on your early childhood, or you were influenced heavily by your early childhood. And I don't know whether your listeners or your followers on social media or in life know just how hard a start you had, and how hard you've had to work, you and Malcolm, to raise your boys and raise your family in the right way, and enjoying the spoils of war now at this stage in life, and just really about how difficult that journey has been. And of course, your very well documented fight with and victory over addiction, and how that shaped you moving forward, and how you've been a young woman in business and having to fight all of those ideas based upon an underprivileged
Gosh, there's so much in there to unpack. I mean, if I focus on the childhood and how, you know, my journey through addiction has shaped me, I think childhood is when you're a little person, you don't have any say in the matter. I always say at that fork in the road, I was shunted down one that I had no say in where it would go. And so I had a very well documented struggle with my childhood with chronic anxiety, which led me into addiction. I really can see the links now that somebody who's fearful and anxious and not really liking of themselves. I think the childhood thing, there's a stigma in, when I was a young girl, there was a stigma. You used to stand in a queue in for free school dinners and you were in a separate queue and you got free school uniform and it wasn't very nice. And so I didn't grow up with a chip on my shoulder, but I certainly grew up, I actually remember wanting to be better than the circumstances that I was in. And that really fueled me to go to university, that I didn't want my life to pan out as being I would end up at a dead end. So there's something about sometimes the grit of a challenging childhood. It's different for all of us, and I never want to diminish anybody else's suffering. But for me, it really made me think, I want better, I want more. And with the addiction, I think it shaped me. I say now that my recovery from alcohol addiction is my superpower, because it taught me that I'm resilient. It also really showed me to be empathetic with others that are going through struggles. And I find that a lot of people will confide in me their struggles because I've got a good listening ear, having walked a bit of the path. And so I look back on my life and I just think, I'm blessed, Freddie. I am really blessed. Here I am doing something that I love, interviewing amazing people. And I doubt that all the great things that have happened to me in my life would have arisen had it not been for the fact that I'm quite tenacious, and that I'm also very grateful for all these gifts that have been laid at my door. But yeah, I always think there are people that had a lot worse childhoods. There are people that sailed through childhood. I was probably in the middle where it wasn't great, but it was lovely writing a short story in The Boutique, my fiction book, that really was my story. So thank you for that question, Freddie. And, you know, it's been absolutely lovely having you on the show today. And I'm sure that our listeners will get so much from listening to you. And I'm just going to round off now by sharing, as usual, a few thoughts with you. I want to talk today about the importance of celebrating your successes, because when you give yourself permission to celebrate, you're on the road to cultivating a positive mindset. If you're feeling happy, powerful and confident, then you're open to embracing new opportunities in the business world. And I guess I want to ask you, are you doing this presently? Are you reflecting on the amazing things that you bring to the table? Are you reflecting and celebrating your successes, big and small? I really hope so. Because if you're like me, you can spend too much time reflecting on what didn't work out as planned, on remonstrating with yourself, when really you should be bringing your kind and compassionate voice into play. So I guess I'm saying, if you take one thing this week from my show, I just want you to make a mental note to praise yourself whenever the opportunity arises. You are a superhuman, but you're a human nevertheless. That's me, Dee Blick, signing off from Lead Well, Live Well. Thank you so much for joining me today.
You've been listening to Lead Well, Live Well on UK Health Radio.